My name is Ted Davis, and I am functioning not only as the first presenter, but also as the chair. So we will take the four papers in order. I'll express a slight concern that I don't see Walter Bradley here. He is the fourth paper, and I don't know whether his presentation's on the laptop. So we'll deal with that in an hour and a half. I will have each of the presenters introduce him or herself when they are ready to go. So I'm professor of the history of science at Messiah College. My primary interest is the history of Christianity and science, and this paper comes from a recently finished book project that has not yet got a publishing house to accept it. I'm going to give the same paper to the History of Science Society later this fall and to the Conference on Faith and History. So it's got interdisciplinary audiences.
It's already a TED Talk. So.
Yeah, so there's already is a TED Talk.
That's right.
Okay. This wonderful image, a chromolithograph by Udo Kepler called The Last Stand, Science versus Superstition, was the centerfold for his magazine, Puck, in July 1899. Published just 3 years after Andrew Dixon White's History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, it brilliantly displays the close links between White's conflict thesis and American religious liberalism at the time. The bearded man bent over the Gatling gun even bears some resemblance to White, but actually he's the radical Jewish thinker Felix Adler, founder of the Ethical Culture Movement and the Ethical Culture School in New York, whose most famous alumnus is probably atomic physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. Adler's gun is labeled History, Archaeology, Evolution, Enlightenment, and Geology. And the boxes of ammunition are labeled Scientific Facts, Historical Facts, and Rational Religion. His allies, gathered under the banner Think or Be Damned, are identified as four prominent liberal ministers. Left to right, Episcopalian priest Richard Heber Newton, an early proponent of the social gospel. Theologian Charles Augustus Briggs, who was expelled by the Presbyterian Church for heresy. Congregationalist theologian Lyman Abbott, a social progressive and early proponent of evolution. And, feeding rounds into the gun, Unitarian minister Minot Judson Savage. Now, I don't expect any of you who aren't historians to know who they were, but you heard the range of representation there. That's what mattered for my purposes. Their opponents are a group of unidentified clergy emerging from the castle of medieval dogmatism, which is terminology come straight from White, and united under a banner proclaiming believe or be damned. In a subtle touch, the defenders of orthodoxy are emerging from the darkness, since we see them only by a searchlight planted firmly on the side of reason. This cartoon underscores an important fact about White and his ideas. Unlike the new atheists of our own day, who borrow extensively without hesitation from White to advance their own agenda of unbelief in the name of science and reason, White was promoting a very liberal type of religion, a broad and vague theism, almost entirely untethered to Christianity, against all forms of traditional Christianity. That's what his warfare book was all about. The main source of conflict with science in the history of Christendom was what White called dogmatic theology, a term he used as a pejorative against religious opponents, whom he regarded as nothing more than obscurantists fighting a losing battle. He wanted Christian ethics to remain a crucial element in the modern world. And in his view, that could happen only if theology got out of the way, preferably quietly and peacefully, but as quickly as possible, so that the progressive religion could flow on, as he says, beneficent and beautiful. Now, to get more perspective on the larger picture, let's step back to 1880. 21 years after Darwin published On the Origin of Species, when the first American Darwinian, Harvard botanist Asa Gray, spoke to the theology students at Yale. Thinking of the halcyon days when the revered Benjamin Silliman set the tone for natural history at Yale with a classical concordist model. Silliman, I should add, is probably the first American ever to use the term progressive creation. Gray recalled an earlier time, quote, when schemes for reconciling Genesis with geology had importance in the churches. And many saw a need to bring the details of the two into agreement by extraneous suppositions and forced constructions of language. Furthermore, our veneration for the Old Testament is not impaired by the fact that Genesis is not an original but a compiled cosmogony. For the older material in Genesis was purged of polytheism and pantheism and nature worship, and impregnated with ideas which we suppose the world will never outgrow. That's all being quoted. The fundamental note of Genesis for Gray is the declaration of one God, maker of heaven and earth, and of all things visible and invisible, a declaration for which, if physical science is unable to establish, it is equally unable to overthrow. Thus, Gray confessed, I accept Christianity on its own evidence, and yet I am yet to learn how physical or any other science conflicts with it any more than it conflicts with simple theism. End of quote. Now, if you are inclined for a moment to read Gray's optimistic, even winsome embrace of modernity as a confession of a thoroughgoing theological modernist, take a deep breath, for he was about to reveal himself as a traditional Christian, despite his wholehearted acceptance of evolution. The frankly incarnational understanding, he went on to express, leaves no other possibility to the interpreter. I take it, he said, that religion is based on the idea of a divine mind revealing himself to intelligent creatures for moral ends. Indeed, revelation culminated in the advent of a divine person, capital D, capital P, who, being made man, manifested the divine nature in union with the human. And this manifestation constitutes Christianity. The incarnation for Gray was simply the crowning miracle, he says, attended by other miracles that he also accepted. In this way, he could consistently proclaim his acceptance of Darwin alongside his faith in Christ, a faith whose essential contents, he says, are briefly summed up by the Apostles and Nicene Creeds. Fast forward to 1936. 3 years after Shaler Matthews retired as Dean of the University of Chicago Divinity School. That place was the geographical and theological center of Protestant modernism in North America. In the autobiography he published that year, aptly entitled New Faith for Old, in a fascinating chapter called Religion and Science, he had this to say. It is yet to be seen how far intelligence is consonant with religion. Then what follows is pure, unadulterated Andrew Dixon White. He says, as natural forces replace divinity and bacteria replace devils, the area of fear within which religions have had control contracts. To become credible for modern times, Matthews argued, religion had to recognize what science had done and what it had done to religion. Laboratory science, he said, did something more than lead to research. It undermined habits of thought and substituted the tentativeness of experiment for authoritative formulas. That's a reference, in my view, to the Orthodox creeds. Those are the authoritative formulas he means. True, he said, there were some scientists like Asa Gray who championed Darwinian evolution while holding to the Nicene Creed. That's how he puts it. But Matthews did not think Gray was worth emulating. Why not? Well, scientific method had not yet reached religious thought, he said. It was only when the educational processes had ceased to be controlled by the study of classical literature and grew more contemporary, that's owing to science, that Orthodox theology was felt to be incompatible with intellectual integrity. That's how he put it. Now, likewise, The radical modernist theologian Gerald.
Well, this happened yesterday.
Yeah, this happened yesterday.
About this time.
I guess that's the end of my paper.
Does the computer still work?
The computer still works.
You should just keep going without your slides.
Just keep going without your slides.
He'll get the lady.
But she can fix it in about 2 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. But you shouldn't slow down. Just keep going. Unless you want to do Q&A now.
I'll just keep going with the text.
Terry can
probably. Maybe. Sharon's not here.
Let us pray. Okay. Likewise, the radical modernist theologian Gerald Birney Smith, who taught a correspondence course on modern theology at Matthews' Chicago Seminary, recommended White's book as, quote, a most readable and striking account of the gradual substitution of the empirical method for the method of conformity to authorized doctrine in various realms of thought. Answer. Okay, let me come back to Smith again. I'll read Smith again. Okay, Smith teaches this correspondence course about science and theology at Chicago. That's a long story I won't delve into. But he recommends White's book, History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, right in his syllabus. He says it's a most readable and striking account of the gradual substitution of the empirical method for the method of conformity to authorized doctrine in various realms of thought. It reflects the scientific man's impatience with the traditional theological ideal. Now, to be sure, Matthews and his fellow modernists had much in common with Gray. They believed that evolution and religious faith were not contradictory. They believed that the world still bore evidence of purposeful intelligence. Indeed, physicist Arthur Holly Compton, the third American to receive the Nobel Prize, belonged to the same church as Matthews in Chicago. And he spoke bluntly of needing, quote, intelligent design, that exact word, term, to understand the history of the universe. What the modernists did not believe in common with Gray, however, was the Nicene Creed. The irony here is profound. The God, worshipped by the leading American evolutionist of Darwin's day, was still, in a meaningful sense, the maker of heaven and earth, and of all that is seen and unseen. Yet the leading American theological educator, two generations later, could not accept this, allegedly because of science. For Matthews, the fundamental problem with what Gray himself had called theistic evolution was not that it accepted evolution, but that it tried to be genuinely theistic in doing so. Now, Matthews did sometimes give the appearance of not believing in God at all. One of his friends at Chicago, physicist Robert Millikan, the second American to receive the Nobel Prize, recalled an occasion when Matthews was asked whether he believed in God, only to reply, "That, my friend, is a question which requires an education rather than an answer." Like Matthews, Millikan also wanted a new Christian faith to replace the old, the practical religion of Jesus without the Jesus of traditional religion, a congregationalist with Unitarian convictions who strove to bring Caltech back to its universalist religious roots. That's another story I can tell in the quick Q&A if you want. Millikan wanted a God who was wholly immanent within the world and not at all transcendent over it. A God incapable of performing miracles or becoming literally incarnate in Christ. Now, nothing was more important to many modernists than the God they found within the evolutionary process itself, rather than imputative explanatory gaps in that process. What might be missed, however, is the degree to which some pitted divine immanence against divine transcendence, not as two crucial poles in an ongoing dialectic, but as a stark choice to be made with finality, in which the transcendent God was effectively discarded entirely. A pertinent example comes from Samuel Christian Schmucker. This was the Neil deGrasse Tyson of the 1920s. I do not exaggerate that. I do not exaggerate, except this man was a religious Christian. Schmucker was frequently a speaker at Matthews' beloved Chautauqua Institution and one of the most successful popularizers of evolution and eugenics in the early 20th century. Schmucker all but equated his immanent God with the evolutionary process itself. The laws of nature, he stated, are not the decisions of any man or group of men, not even, I say it reverently, of God. The laws of nature are eternal, even as God is eternal. They are not the fiat of the Almighty God. They are the manifestations in nature of the presence of the indwelling God. I'm quoting the little shirt pocket-sized tract you see here. His diffusively conceived God was co-eternal with the world, equally old with the world, and virtually indistinguishable from the laws of nature. The evolutionary progress those laws had produced was the ultimate source of his hope. I cannot escape the impression that White would have loved this had he lived to see it. Now, White's two-volume screed had first appeared in 1896, just in time to precipitate an intense spiritual crisis in the life of the young man later regarded by Martin Luther King Jr., who was no mean preacher himself, as the greatest preacher of the 20th century, namely Harry Emerson Fosdick. Decades later, in May 1922, less than 2 years after the word fundamentalist was first used, Fosdick preached perhaps the most famous sermon of the 20th century, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" The ensuing controversy led him to leave the Presbyterian denomination and become pastor of Park Avenue Baptist Church, where John David Rockefeller Jr. was a highly influential member. A few years later, Rockefeller, who was one of the leading funders of science in an era that didn't have the NIH or NSF, built the magnificent Riverside Church, in some ways a temple of science, specifically for Fosdick. Now, following his first year as a student at Colgate, Fosdick encountered White, and its effect on him was devastating. Here's what he said in his autobiography. "What finally smashed the whole idea of biblical inerrancy for me was a book by Andrew D. White. It seemed to me unanswerable. Here were the facts, shocking facts, about the way the assumed infallibility of the scriptures had impeded research, deepened and prolonged obscurantism, fed the mania of persecution, and held up the progress of mankind. I no longer believed the old stuff I had been taught. Moreover, I no longer merely doubted it. I rose in indignant revolt against it." Like many other modernists, Fosdick lifted the conflict picture out of White and Draper uncritically from his plate and dutifully swallowed it whole, taking its alleged facts as gospel truths to illuminate a new path to righteousness. Now, one of Fosdick's countless admirers, Princeton biologist Edwin Grant Conklin, a leading public intellectual between the world wars, had originally endorsed Asa Gray's religious position as a junior scientist. As he grew older, however, he changed his mind, culminating a process that had begun during his graduate studies at Johns Hopkins, where he was deeply influenced by the naturalistic credo of his mentor, William Keith Brooks. As Conklin put it, Brooks held that the term supernatural is due to a misconception. Nature is everything that is. In a spiritual autobiography that he wrote toward the end of his life for the conservative Jewish rabbi Louis Finkelstein, chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, Conklin said, "With the progress of science, the area of the supernatural and miraculous has gradually grown smaller. Yet supernatural agencies or occurrences constitute the very foundations of many religions." Conklin saw his own spiritual journey as one that Orthodox friends might interpret as descending steps, leading him further from the traditional Methodist faith of his youth. "My gradual loss of faith in many Orthodox beliefs," he recalled, "came inevitably with increasing knowledge of nature and growth of a critical sense. Significantly, he identified Draper and White as formative influences. As he saw it, they showed the impossibility of harmonizing many traditional doctrines of theology with the demonstrations of modern science. Whether or not White directly influenced their thinking, the modernist Protestants of the early 20th century uncritically accepted the conflict thesis as a crucial component of their worldview. By holding such a negative attitude toward traditional Christian theology, they actually eliminated, for them, the very possibility of having a genuine Christian dialogue with science, rather than just a monologue dominated by science. Precisely the result that White sought wholeheartedly and so successfully to bring about. Of this, there can really be no doubt. Although White denied genuine conflict between religion and science, he did more than anyone else to create the very type of conflict that is so stridently embraced by so many today, in which science tries to drive Christian theology into intellectual disrepute. And he did all of that, as we now know in the historical community, on the basis of bogus history, despite the salient fact that he had been the first president of the American Historical Association. I'll just take a couple extra minutes to wrap up, considering the difficulties we've had here. Intellectual descendants of today's modernists continue to uphold the conflict thesis, even though they often deny it. And this is ironic. Despite their own strongly articulated denials of the conflict thesis, many contemporary Protestant authors implicitly accept the warfare thesis of A.D. White. That is, they agree with White that traditional theology has proved unable to engage science in fruitful conversation, and so they seek to discard it. To offer just one very prominent example, the retired Episcopalian Bishop of Newark, John Shelby Spong, believes that science has somehow made theism itself incredible. So he tries to take Christianity beyond theism, to use his words. I'm reminded of that text in the New Testament asking whether any good thing can come out of Newark. The new atheists go even further, proclaiming what I call the hard conflict thesis, while White's descendants accept a softer version. Proponents of the harder form want to rid the world entirely of all religion, except their own religion of science, which they naively do not even recognize as a form of religion. Proponents of the softer form want to keep religion and spirituality, but want to remove traditional Christian beliefs root and branch, thus avoiding, in their view, any conflict with science, to the extent that both groups need White's conflict thesis to make their narratives work, they have built their castles on historical sand. Thanks for listening to those remarks. Ian.
Thanks very much, Ted. What springs to my mind is the question which maybe you have some thoughts about, but you haven't shared with us, and that is, why did people buy into the conflict as portrayed by Andrew Dixon White so easily, where our modern historical research, your own and that of many other people, shows how poor, in fact, the history of White's book and related polemic was? Why did they buy it?
Well, I would say two answers. One answer is they recognized a fellow traveler. Many of White's followers were fellow liberal religionists, liberal in the sense of Matthew Arnold. They found in the world the power greater than us that makes for righteousness. That's how Matthew Arnold defines religion. And so they bought that, and they liked White's narrative about that's what religion really is. That's true religion, not this doctrinal stuff. And secondly, many people were taken in, including many historians of early generations, such as Thomas Kuhn, were taken in by the hocus-pocus of White's really long, detailed footnotes, which, when you track them down to their sources, often do not support at all the interpretation he's giving, and in some cases, go to sources that don't exist, or that cite sources, other sources that cite things that don't exist, such as the famous quotation that White and then Thomas Kuhn attribute to John Calvin about Copernicus, when Copernicus is mentioned nowhere in anything Calvin ever wrote. There's a quote, a spurious quotation attributed to Calvin in White that everybody else quotes. And White gets it from somewhere else who didn't do his homework. So that's the answer to that. Paul?
Great question. Yeah. So, Ted.
Yeah. Well, I'm a historian, not a prophet. And nor am I an experimental historian. I can't go out and pluck. I can't go into the lab and pluck out that gene and then find out what happens afterward. Unfortunately.
Yes. So, I just kind of related to that question, I wonder if is White sort of following the modernist movement, the theological liberal progressive movement from the theologians that started this, and then, you know, plugged science into it, whereas, you know, I think some of the scientists you're quoting seem to pull on White as the source of their modernist events. But, how distinguished are those two movements?
Well, we now know much better the real story of White's book, and I don't have time to relate that. A dissertation under Peter Harrison at Queensland was written in the last couple of years, and I was an external reader. So I know the dissertation really well. And it's excellent. It's going to be published by University of Pittsburgh Press. And it shows White's own religious journey, his personal story. He was deeply anti-traditional religion for a number of reasons. So was John William Draper, the other kind of warfare person. And that predates the emergence, really, of a modernist theology in the United States, although there are early forms of that in Europe. But it's that theology doesn't really... I hope this is right, and I'm asking Jack to tell me if it's not. But as I can see it, the types of theology that identify themselves by their own word modernist, as the fundamentalists identify themselves by their own word fundamentalist, they appear late 19th, very late 19th century, and then in the early 20th. Would that be right, Jack?
Well, if I could ask a question here, could you give some other examples of where White got it wrong? Maybe any examples where he got the history right.
The number one example where White gets it wrong is probably that Calvin quotation that I didn't quote in full because I don't have that text in front of me, but it's just a single sentence. But other areas where he gets it wrong would have to do with Vesalius being hunted to death for his views. There's a lot of examples. I think he gets it right a little in terms of some of the opposition expressed to certain scientific ideas in the United States in the early 19th century, including the idea of an ancient Earth. He gets some of that right. There's enough in there that's right that it sounds good, but the material is rotten to the core. Historically, I think it's fair to speak on the part of the whole historical community. I mean, I know what the state of opinion is on this. There are conferences just about White that are held these days, and I'm part of those. Nobody believes that White is a valid secondary source. White is a primary source for what late 19th century progressive thinkers in America believed about science and religion. But you never follow White if you're a good historian. You never do it. You dig into the footnotes and see what's really there before you go any further. And often what's there is not there. There's no there there in the end when it's done. Time for just one more here. I think this gentleman had his hand up for a while.
I'm interested in the overall merit of modernism and theology.
Right.
So you point to the science side of that. Are they same figures?
engaged with continental thought, like Schleiermacher and so forth? Is that part of the movement as well?
The religious thinkers absolutely were. I mean, the theologians at the turn of the century are engaged with German theology. Does White himself read German theology? He's probably read a little of it. White is a very skilled historian. He lacks the PhD, but lots of people did in those days in academic world. He's trained in European history, and he spends a couple of years on the continent, in Germany and in France. So he's reading things there all over the place. I wouldn't be at all surprised if his full reading list included people like Schleiermacher. I wouldn't be surprised at all. In fact, he's such a good linguist and such a good interpersonal communicator that he's named the United States representative to Tsarist Russia. And he spends a couple of years in the legation in St. Petersburg, and that's where he writes the famous preface to his book, where he has the metaphor about the peasants on the River Neva breaking up the ice in the spring, and that the ice dam is theology, and the river behind it is advancing truth, including science. And it's best, he thinks, to chip away at that little by little, at that ice barrier, until the truth can flow on, beneficent and beautiful, see, to prevent a damage that would occur if it all ruptured at once. So White's an evolutionist in hoping for slow change in American thinking, rather than a revolutionist who wants it all right away. He thinks there's a benefit for having it happen slowly, and people can kind of take it on board bit by bit. Well, that's the last one I think we have time for.